Great. Well, thanks a lot for the invitation. It's great to be giving this talk today. I've never been to PI in person, even though I did my PhD in Canada pretty close by. But this is not a hidden complaint. Rob has invited me many times. It just never worked out. So hopefully next time it'll be in person. But for now, we'll have to do it Zoom. Great. So today I'll be talking about some recent work. So a paper that came out a couple of weeks ago. And we'll also have a longer paper out, you know, hopefully, say, by the end of the month or the end of the year. And it's joint work with Eyoa Bahiru and Idil Farvardian, who are two grad students that are on the postdoc market this year that are in CISA, and Kyriakos Papadodimas and Gabor Sorosi, who are at CERN. And maybe just one starting comment is that I imagine that, like me, you're pretty tired of Zoom by now. I decided that I'll give all my remote talks Blackboard style, so I'll be writing in real time, which means I'll go slower, but hopefully this way it's more interactive, and please stop me as many times as you want, and hopefully, yeah, it will be a more interactive talk this way. Great. So the question I want to be addressing in the talk today is the following. Can we localize information or quantum information in quantum gravity? Okay, and I should perhaps first start telling you what I mean by localizing information and talk about contexts that are perhaps more familiar to you. So what do we mean by localizing information? And when can we do it? When do we know we can do it? So the simplest case where it works, and it's very well understood, is quantum field theory. Okay, so in quantum field theory, it works. We can localize information. This ultimately comes from the fact that, you know, operators at space-like separation commute if x, y are space-like. And there's many different ways you can phrase it. One nice way to phrase it is through split states. So it's a theorem that these states exist, so they're called split states. So imagine dividing your spatial region on which your quantum field theory lives into three regions, A, B, and C. And split states are such that, so there exist states called split states that are such that A and C are completely unentangled. Okay, now in quantum field theory, there's a lot of entanglement in the UV. There's, you know, local degrees of freedom are strongly interacting. So what you need to do is you need to leave a little buffer region B here, such that the energy, such that these states have finite energy. But provided you leave a little buffer region B here, you can completely unentangle degrees of freedom in A and C. Okay, so for example, if you compute correlators would be called a split state. You compute correlators that are strictly located in A, and it's impossible for you to tell. So maybe all these correlation functions are exactly equal to what they would be in the vacuum, the global vacuum of the quantum field theory. But there are, you could act with some operators in C and not change the correlators in A at all. Okay. And so you can localize information because there's many operators that you could act with in C. Well, I should really act with them on the slice, I guess. You have to build them in a clever way, but you know, about split states, you can act with these operators, and correlation functions in A will be completely incapable of detecting whether you have inserted or not these operators in C. Okay. So you can completely localize quantum information. And maybe I should emphasize that this is even true in a gauge theory. Now you might worry in a gauge theory, you know, say in QED, you might say, oh, but what if I insert a positive charge at some place in region C that's gonna, you know, radiate some electric field and I'll be able to detect it very far away. And that's a true statement, but there are other types of operators. So first of all, in QED, you know, just inserting a positive charge, inserting an electron is not really a gauge invariant operator. What you would need to do is insert E plus and E minus and have a Wilson line connecting them. Okay, now this is a gauge invariant operator, and you can act with it in C, and you'll be incapable of detecting it from A. Okay, so even if you have a gauge theory, this works. And it works because there's plus or minus charges, and we'll see that's something that's very different in gravity in a second. Okay, so in quantum field theory, we can localize information, and we understand very well how to do it.
Alex, I have a quick question about the gauge theory case. Hi, by the way.
Oh.
What if you have a single charged operator that you insert and you dress it with a Wilson line to like the asymptotic boundary instead of to another like finite distance opposite charge particle?
Oh, well, so this was a bit one dimensional, but imagine,
I'm imagining higher dimensions. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me draw a 2D picture. If this is your region C, and this is your region B, and this is your region A, if you act with create a plus charge in C, the field might radiate away, and no matter where you will be able to detect it somewhere in A, right?
Yeah, and that's not a problem for your localization statement?
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, so that would be bad, but the point is that there, to localize information, what's really important is that there exist operators that are strictly localized and that you cannot detect from far away. And for example, this Wilson line that I was drawing before would be an example of it.
The precise statement is just that, like, if you compute these correlation functions in the split state in your region A, the information is deemed localized if there's a class of local operators in C that you can insert that aren't going to affect those correlations.
Exactly.
You don't need any statements on like how dense those local operators or like dense. They don't have to generate the whole algebra of local operators or anything like that.
No, it turns out that typically that they actually, I didn't want it to get into the gauge theory case too precisely, but it turns out that, depends which split states you construct, but there are split states where you can even hide the insertion of E plus because there's this buffer region B, and you can construct the split state such that, basically it knows to put a minus charge if you put a plus charge in C. So, you can even screen the charge by allowing to have also like plus or negative charges in B.
Thank you.
So it depends a bit what you want to do. But even if you don't want to allow that, there exist operators that are strictly localized in C and indetectable.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, thanks. So these are great questions, and please keep them coming. So that's quantum field theory, and we understand it well. Something that we also understand very well is classical gravity. And in classical gravity, again, the answer is yes, you can localize information. So in classical gravity, if you think about a kind of canonical way to decompose the phase space, you talk about some Cauchy slice, and then you look at the phase space variables on this Cauchy slice, which are the induced metric and the extrinsic curvature. If you had matter, also phi and pi of the matter fields. And in classical gravity, what you can do is you can, excite these degrees of freedom, put a little bump of matter here. And you also not be able to detect it from infinity. Now, we need to be a little bit more precise because gravity is different because there are constraints and you can read something off from infinity. So, you can read off the total mass, for example, from infinity. Okay, so if you're trying to distinguish between no wrinkles at all and a wrinkle, that you will be able to do. But if you have two wrinkles that produce for you the same total mass at infinity, as read out from infinity, that have the same ADN mass, will not be able to tell which of the two wrinkles you have just by looking at data at infinity. Okay, so there are constraints, but for example, if this wrinkle and some other one that looked more like this, if they're in the same symmetry class and they have the same total mass, they insert the same total energy in the system, you will not be able to tell from infinity which of the two you have.
How do you handle an angle-dependent body mass? Like, or is Luca going to back me up?
Sorry, can you ask me a question?
Yes.
How do you handle like an angle dependent bonding mass? And that statement doesn't sound like what I would expect for. Like if you have a particle, say, that's moving really quickly, right? That there's going to be some, like it's not just going to be constant as a function of the sphere far away. Like you can kind of see that.
So if you're saying if there's a rotating, so this applies to all the charges, right? So if there's angular momentum, you would also be able to read the angular momentum off from infinity.
No, so I guess my question is like, what's your take on like the whole asymptotic symmetry story and like the fact that like you want to basically resolve the bonding mass at every direction? Sorry, maybe I'm just going to have a deep cut into one particular thing, but.
Okay, good. I think that's a refinement that you need to worry about. But that is not in contradiction with the statement that I'm making. So I think it is true that there exists, and I think there are theorems about this. Like Wald's book has a lot of good stuff about this. There are theorems that say that you can change the initial data in a compactly supported region, and provided you do that in a way that has the same total energy, it's indistinguishable from infinity.
I'm sorry. Can I follow on that? I'm a bit confused, and it just I'm a bit confused by that because there's. In principle, you have infinitely many asymptotic symmetries for the system you're talking about. And the latest understanding in this topic is that if we really know all of them, you should be able to reconstruct the information everywhere. So I'm a bit confused. Now, it depends if you're talking about an instant of time at infinity, or you're really following the full flux of information that come from these two wrinkles that you've done throughout infinity. If you have that, the latter, then you should be able to distinguish green and red.
Yes, absolutely. No, absolutely. Because obviously these wrinkles, you insert them at one moment in time and they'll radiate out, right? So I'm really talking about one moment in time. So okay. Imagine here's your asymptotic boundary. And I'm only allowing you to do, measurements or whatever on this slice, right?
Right. So in that slice, you will know that asymptotic charges are codimension 2. So the information that you've put in the middle will be stored in the corner at infinity. So, and there are infinitely many charges. So in principle, I should be able to tell you whether I'm green or red on that slice. Maybe it's a bit technical at this point. I don't want to bother you too much about it, but it seems to contradict your statement.
Well, I guess this one way to phrase the statement that I'm making is Birkhoff's theorem. If you have a spherically symmetric solution, and you have two different spherically symmetric solutions that are compactly supported and have the same energy, outside the place where they're compactly supported, they look like Schwarzschilds, right?
Not if they're moving.
What does it mean if they're moving? I'm just talking about initial data.
Sure. No. I think I'm saying that, as an example, maybe this isn't exactly right, but if you wanted to build up an angle dependent bonding mass, the thing that you would need for like the analog for the charge would be to have a bunch of charges that aren't just static but are actively like moving with a net like velocity, like so the state that corresponds at a given instant, a moving mass or charge, will have some angle dependence to its bonding mass, and or like radial field, right?
So if you read it from the point of view, for instance, of celestial holography, you would say that if you know all the possible, correlation, function, and stuff at your boundary, for this, you should be able to tell the difference between these two at the boundary, at that slice. So that's the thing that I agree with you, that if you just care about the first modes in the multiple expansion, so you just say mass and angular momentum, then yes, that's Birkhoff. You can produce two things that looks the same at the boundary, but they are not in the bulk. But that's because you're only wondering about these two features, right? So then I agree with you. Then it's essentially no Herr theorems if you want, but there are Herrs that arrive at the boundary that can tell you whether you're winkling in one way or the other.
And that are visible purely classically?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Okay. Maybe we should discuss this more at the end. This is very
absolutely. I apologize for interrupting.
Not at all. When I said I wanted questions, this is exactly what I had in mind. So I think this is very interesting. And I haven't thought about asymptotic symmetries too much, to be honest. But I think it's an interesting point. So, modulo these issues that I guess we'll come back to and hopefully resolve later in the talk. I think this is fairly well understood. And the question now is, what about quantum gravity? Now, here it depends what you mean by quantum gravity. So if you mean fully non-perturbative quantum gravity, then we believe that the answer is no, right? Because you know, one way to phrase the statement of holography is that there are no local degrees of freedom, and all information is stored at the boundary. This is meant to hold as a non-perturbative statement. And certainly, for example, if you believe in ADS-CFT, I think it's just clear that you cannot hide information. If you know exactly the quantum state of the dual CFT completely, that tells you everything there is to know. But this is really a non-perturbative statement about quantum gravity. You need to know the full non-perturbative state. You need to know everything there is to know. Okay. So a more interesting question, which is sort of the gray region between these two situations, is what about Jin-Yun perturbation theory? Okay, so what's the status in not in non-perturbative quantum gravity, but only keeping into account perturbative effects in Jin-Yun? Okay, we know eventually if you keep track of all non-perturbative effects, it'll fill. But what about Jin-Yun perturbation theory? You might have your own opinion of, or you might have your own pre-made opinion of whether you think it's natural that it'll go towards the green or towards the red. But here's one reason why you should be worried is that if you try to create a local operator somewhere in a space-time region, first of all, this operator is not diff invariant. Right, you can't just say I want to create a local operator. There, you have to specify its location in a different variant way, right? And our favorite way on how to do that is by doing what's called the gravitational dressing. So if you want, we add a gravitational Wilson line to the operator, like we were doing before in ENM. And the most natural place to attach this gravitational Wilson line is to the asymptotic boundary, if you have one. But then now if you go and compute the commutator of the Hamiltonian, which is a boundary term in GR, with this local operator, it's no longer going to be zero. Okay. In fact, it's going to be order G-Newton or maybe square root of G-Newton. Okay. So this is a fact that if you want in the non-back reacting limit when G-Newton is literally zero and you're doing just quantum field theory, you can do, but as soon as you turn on a little bit of G-Newton, you try to act with a local operator somewhere, you have to gravitationally address it to somewhere, and you usually do it to the boundary, but then if you act with the particle, you can detect it from the boundary, okay? Because it changes the energy by a little bit. Okay, and this is nothing but the gravitational Gauss law, and it seems to suggest that perhaps there's an issue in that, localizing information already fails in Jin-Yun perturbation theory. Okay? There's more careful arguments that you can go through. There's a very nice paper by Olga and Subrat and friends where they study this around the ADS vacuum in the context of ADS-CFT and show that a strong version of this gravitational Gauss law shows that you cannot localize information. Okay. And one thing that I want to stress is, why is this question so important? It's because answering this question is also sort of telling you in some sense whether holography is trivial or not. you know, could we have guessed holography, I don't know, decades ago? We've known that the Hamilton, you know, that the Hamiltonian in GR is a boundary term, right? Does that imply holography? If the answer here is no in perturbation theory, I would say yes. In some sense, it applies holography. All information is visible near the boundary, and you could have figured it out just by knowing that the Hamiltonian is a boundary term in GR. If you need non-perturbative effects, then it's more subtle, and it's something that is sort of invisible from just the gravitational analysis. Okay, so in some sense, the outcome of this answer is pretty important.
I might have literally missed, I just want to say it back in case I missed it. In your last slide, did you say that, at the end you concluded that if I do perturbation theory in quantum gravity, then I see Gauss's law being violated, but you're saying in classical gravity, I wouldn't, did I repeat that right?
In classical gravity, you would as well. If you do quantum field theory in a curved background and literally take G Newton to zero, then you can excite any number, then you're just in quantum field theory on a fixed background. And then you can, excite operators deep in the middle and not detect them from the boundary. Because now this is just QFT. But as soon as you turn on a little bit of G Newton, you run into this problem. Good. So what's my goal for today? It's pretty simple. I want to give some evidence that in fact you can localize information in genuine perturbation theory. Okay, to all orders, presumably, and it's not a foolproof, but it's what I think is pretty strong evidence, and as you'll see, I'll explain you exactly what we showed. I'll construct, approximately local operators, and I'll do that explicitly. Okay, and there's a caveat which is sort of important, which is that this will only work for some states. Okay, and I'll do it in the context of ADS CFT, but hopefully it's more general. Okay, so that's my goal for today. And just before I get started, I just want to make two further comments. The first one is that this is relevant for the information paradox. Because say you want to study the information paradox in flat space, one thing that you would like to do is, collect Hawking radiation and compute the entanglement entropy of Hawking radiation to see if it follows a page curve, a unitary page curve or not. But in a flat space situation like this, there's no non-gravitating region where you can, sort of rigorously define entanglement entropy. Okay, so if you cannot define entanglement entropy, then you don't know exactly what you're computing. So perhaps you can't define, a completely well-defined entanglement entropy like you would in QFT, but if you can approximately localize information to all orders in genuine perturbation theory, you might imagine that you can sort of split the Hilbert space this way and, compute S of outside of the dashed line. And you do it using this sort of approximate notion of locality, and that will give you some quantity that could follow the page curve. Okay. So that's one reason that you might care about this. And the second comment is that what I'll be saying today has pretty interesting connections with a lot of work that has appeared recently about von Neumann algebras. Okay, so there's been work by Euler, Tursor, and Pennington, Chandrasekharan, Longo, and Witten in various combinations. But I don't know, maybe like me, you're a little bit scared by von Neumann algebras and you find them very abstract. And hopefully what I tell you today is, I think, much more constructive. So I think it's more explicit, okay? And hopefully it gives you a feel a little bit of how you do these things. Okay, good. So the plan for the rest of the talk is pretty simple. So this was my introduction. So I want to define these local operators. And tell you their properties, why we think they're approximately local operators. And then I'll just discuss their interpretation. And I think that will take us basically to the end of the talk. And then maybe we can come back to this question of soft charges. Or maybe we'll do that before then, we'll see. Great. So that's the plan. It's pretty simple, but before I get started, let me just maybe stop here and see if there's any questions. Okay, doesn't look like it, so I'll get started. Okay, so if you want to probe questions related to locality and localizing information, I think the sort of most natural first step is to try to construct candidate local operators. Oh, and maybe I should have said this, but for the rest of the talk, I'll be talking about ADS-CFT. So my construction will be in ADS-CFT, but hopefully some of the lessons that we learned are also applicable to flat space and perhaps even to this inner space. But for the rest of the talk, I'll talk about ADS-CFT. So there's sort of two routes that you can take if you want to try to construct candidate local operators. The first one is to do it directly in the bulk. Okay, so you can take your favorite local operator when gnewton is zero, turn on gnewton a little bit, do the gravitational dressing, build this Wilson line that you can try to build order by order in gnewton perturbation theory. But the problem if you try to start with a bulk object is that you're not sure that the thing that you're constructing is really different variant at the non-perturbative level. Okay, so you might have some operator that looks good, but you don't know if it's really truly well-defined non-perturbative. Okay, so I would say this is pretty difficult. An alternative route is to construct it in the CFT. Okay, now if you construct it in the CFT, it's manifestly different variant. Right, because anything that you build out of CFT degrees of freedom, by definition is different variant. Okay, it's also non-perturbatively defined. So the only thing that you need to worry about is, does it act in the right way? Does it do the right thing? Is this the operator that you want? But the question of diff invariance and, non-perturbative definition is built in. You don't need to worry about it as long as you expressed it in terms of a CFT operator. Okay, good. But does it act the right way? Okay, so as I told you, my construction is going to work around the class of states. So the type of states that I'll have in mind are what I'm going to call semi-classical states. The interpretation in the bulk is that they just correspond to semi-classical geometries, but I'll be more quantitative. In particular, they need to satisfy two properties, and these two properties will be enough. Is that the expectation value of the CFT Hamiltonian in these states is of order m squared. Okay, remember this is of order 1 over gnewton, which means that it has a large energy. It's strongly back reacting on the background. And the other thing that will be important is that the variance in this state, so delta h squared, is also of order m squared. Okay, so for example, a thermal state has this property, but one individual black hole microstate does not, right? The variance is zero, but thermal states have this property. Okay, and the way you should think about this physically, what does this mean? Physically, this means that the state is macroscopically time dependent. you know that in the dual CFT, there would be VEVs that are large VEVs that are changing as a function of time. Okay. In fact, you can give a rigorous lower bound on the variance as the time derivative of one point function. Okay. So there's various examples of this type. I already talked about the thermal field double state that has two asymptotic boundaries, but for example, a class of states that I like a lot are those that you get by doing the Euclidean path integral with sources turned on for single trace operators on the hemisphere. Or you can look at boundary states in the CFT and evolve them with some amount of Euclidean time evolution. Or say in the 2D CFT, you can construct them by doing the path integral over half of a genus two surface or dot, dot, dot. Okay, there's many different ways to get these states. This directly prepares some semi-classical geometry with some, you know, initial data for the various fields in your theory. These correspond to states that have end of the world brains behind the horizon. These correspond to states that have topology behind their horizon, and so on and so forth. Okay, these are all families of semi-classical states. Okay, so that's the type of state that we want to consider. And these states have a very nice property. Yes, there's a question.
Sorry,
yes.
I'm a bit confused. So in the last slide, you said these properties are not satisfied by a single black hole microstate.
Correct.
And isn't the boundary state construction corresponds to just a single, one example, single black hole microstate?
No. So people mean different things, but when they say black hole microstates, they mean different things. But a boundary state is a quantum superposition of many different energy eigenstates, right?
Okay.
So sometimes when people say a black hole microstate, they mean any state within a given energy band. They don't care if it's a superposition or not. What I was meaning by black hole microstate here is an energy eigenstate. So this does not work with an energy eigenstate.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, great questions. Okay. So the most important property that I'll need from these states is the following, is that if you look at the overlap of two different states, it goes like a function of m squared as e to the minus m squared with some positive coefficient. Okay, namely that the overlap of two of these states is exponentially small in 1/GU. Okay. And there's various ways that you can convince yourself of that. If you think about them as coherent states, you know that the overlap of two coherent states is basically an exponential depending on the profile. And, you know, n squared is just playing the role of 1/h bar. In many other cases, in some cases, you can calculate this rather explicitly. And we don't have, I think, a full general proof that this is always the case, but I think it's pretty solid. And in particular, the type of thing that we'll be considering is what we define to be the return amplitude, which is the overlap between the state at t equals zero, sorry, this should be t equals zero, and the state at t squared. Okay, and this goes like e to the minus n squared times a function of t, which again is positive. And here you can even check that at early times, it goes like e to the minus n squared t squared. Okay, and you know the most famous version of the return amplitude that I'm sure you've all heard of is if you take your state psi zero to be the thermal field double state, then R of t is just the spectral form factor. Okay, which we all know decays extremely fast at early times. But you can define this more generally for any class of states. Okay. Good. And so now I've told you everything that I need that you need to know about these states, all the properties that they need to have, and everything else that I'll say now just follows from what I've told you here. Okay. And just to give you an idea of how you should think about these states. So these states are coherent states corresponding to a semi-classical geometry. So, you know, you should think about them, you know, maybe there's some infalling matter. And then there's a supernova that happens at the center of ADS, and then it expands back out. And everything here is semi-classical, and these states are describing a geometry that looks like this. The time evolution of these states is describing a geometry that looks like this. Okay, so let's think about these states as a proto example, as you know, a supernova in ADS, supernova explosion in ADS. Okay, good. And now let me phrase the question of locality. So let me define A to be the time band algebra of single trace operators. Okay, so A is the operator algebra of all operators located in a narrow time band here in the CFT. Okay, so you consider the algebra of operators. You can act with any, say, finite number of single trace operators in this time band. So you act here, 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 anywhere you want in this time band, okay? And you build an algebra of this type. And now you ask the following question. Do there exist operators such that the commutator between this operator and the whole algebra is zero? Okay, if the answer is no, that would mean that you cannot localize information. If the answer is yes, the interpretation would be that the types of operators, so now you can extend this time band into the bulk and look at the causal development into the bulk. And the idea would be that you've created an operator that is outside the causal development of your time band. Okay, it's an operator that's further inside than what you can access with the time band. If you find an operator like this, that, you know, that doesn't commute with, that commutes with A, sir.
And sorry, is O in the bulk or O is in the CFT? That's another question.
Sorry,
I might be asking a dumb question. Is the operator that you're looking for like supposed to live in the bulk, or is it also?
Oh yeah, I mean, so I'm going to build a CFT operator, okay? But its interpretation is that it corresponds to something. Local. But it's going to be a purely CFT construction, right? But the interpretation is going to be that it's an operator that sits in here, okay? Because it commutes with the time bound algebra. So it's very easy to convince yourself that if the operator sits here, it doesn't commute with the time band algebra. Good. And now we can understand a little bit more again, this question of perturbative and non-perturbative. So, you know, if you try to do this, if you try to phrase this question non-perturbatively, then, you know, you would have to replace the algebra of single trace operators by the full CFT algebra of all CFT operators. And in fact, you don't even need a time band there. You can look at a single moment in time. And you know that does not have a commutant. There are no operators that commute with the entire CFT algebra. Okay. So then there just doesn't exist an O such that, there's no operator that commutes with the entire CFT. Except identity, but you know, there's no non-trivial operator you can use with the entire algebra of CFT operator. Okay, but in perturbation theory, this is not so obvious, right? In perturbation theory, now we keep only the single trace operators, and we want to ask, is it possible to find operators that commute to all orders in perturbation theory? And the answer may be yes or no. We don't know. I'm going to need one more thing that. I'm sure essentially all of you are familiar with, but let me just write it anyway. I'm going to need what I call HKL operators, which is sort of the canonical way to reconstruct bulk operators in AES-CFT, where you take some CFT operator located at T prime and omega prime, and you integrate it against some kernel that extends into the bulk. And the kernel satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation about a given background. And this is sort of the standard way that we construct a bulk operator in ADS-CFT. But because it's standard and because, you know, to solve this Klein-Gordon equation to find K, you have to pick a gauge. For example, Pfefferman-Graham gauge, it's very easy to see that the HKL operator does not commute with the Hamiltonian. Okay, and this is an order 1 over n effect, so you don't see it at infinite n, but you know, in 1 over n perturbation theory, it starts failing to commute with the Hamiltonian, right? And the Hamiltonian is a single trace operator that lives in the time bands, so the HKL operator cannot work, right? Because it just doesn't commute with one of the operators of the algebra. So we need to do something more fancy. Okay. Good. So now let me come to the result or the proposal. So I'm going to define an operator that I'm going to call phi hat. And phi hat has the following two properties. So one, the commutation of H with phi hat equals zero to all orders in 1/n. And two, phi hat acts like the HKL operator to leading order.
So is it kind of like you're just evolving with like the interaction, like you're changing frames in some sense between the, or I don't.
No, it's good. It's more, it's, you have to, no, you'll see it's more subtle than that. It's more subtle than that. It's a bit of a weird operator. Okay. So what I'm going to do now, I'll define the operator for you and I'll prove these two properties. Okay. And then we'll move on to the interpretation. Okay. So here's the operator. So there's some normalization constant that's not very important. So let me just ignore it. So what you do is you do the following. So you start with the HKL operator as a seed. And then you do some sort of funny operation on it. First on either side, I mean, you could do it just on one side actually, but let's just do it on both sides to make it look more symmetric. You act with a projector on the code subspace. So the idea is that this is going to work. So this is going to be a state dependent operator, and then it'll work for the state psi zero. Okay. And the projector P zero here, what is it? It's a projector onto the code subspace. Of psi zero. Okay, meaning it's a projector onto psi zero and all states that you get by acting with a finite number of single trace operators on psi zero. Okay, so you start with the HKL operator, you multiply by this projector, and now you do a time integral with the Hamiltonian, with the CFT Hamiltonian, up to some time T star, which you can pick at will, but it needs to be at least order one in the large end.
So can I ask a dumb question again? Like, because I guess I'm going to this thing.
Yeah,
so
those aside are from always this, the hardest. So
yeah, it's aside from being a projector onto this code subspace, I guess I would not appreciate better. Like, you are basically taking an operator, time evolving it, and looking at the time average and saying that's invariant under time translations, right?
Yes, but the projector
is the important part. Yeah, okay.
The projector is very important.
And then what's the projector doing for your?
Yeah, you can sort of think about this as doing that, but at the same time projecting it onto the time evolution of the state that you're following. I mean, roughly speaking. Good. Okay. Very good. So this is the operator, and this is the proposal, and then I'll just show you that it satisfies the properties, and you'll see it's pretty easy. It's just a couple of lines. This is going to be the most technical part of the talk, but bear with me. Okay, so let me just write down a formula for the commutator, and you know I may get a sign or two wrong, but hopefully overall it's correct up to and hopefully an even number of sign mistakes. So here's just a way to rewrite the commutator. This is just a way to rewrite the commutator by taking this derivative and evaluating it at s equals to zero. And now we're going to take that and you know throw it into our definition here. Okay. So what does this give us? So there's a c, there's the minus I that goes for the right, and now there's the integral. And you know, basically this e to the ish, they'll just shift around what we had here, right? They'll shift these two time integrals, and you can get rid of those shifts by redefining your time coordinate. So basically, you get the following expression. So T, big T twiddle is now this shifted time coordinate. T0 phi HKLL. T0. This has been shifted now. Well, it doesn't matter. P0 e to the I T twiddle H. Okay. So I inserted this, and this is just a rewriting, and there's a d by ds here, and the whole thing is evaluated at s equals to 0. Okay, but by the fundamental theorem of analysis, or I think that's what it's called, reduces to boundary terms. Okay, so what does this give us? I times this constant c, which I told you shouldn't worry about, pt phi hkll. T star by HKLL translated at T star minus the thing at minus T star. HKLL minus T star. Okay, there we go. Minus T star. Good. Okay, so that's the commutator. But now if you take this commutator and you insert it in the state psi zero, which is what we wanted to compute, you know, how does it commute with the Hamiltonian in our state psi zero? This thing is going to involve basically terms which are trace pt star p zero, okay, which is another way to rewrite psi of t star psi of zero. And I told you that this was exponentially suppressed, right? This was like e to the minus some function of t star that's positive times m squared, okay? So these two boundary terms that you have that remain, they're exponentially small in n squared. Exactly how exponentially small depends exactly what you pick for t star, and this is a choice. There's not one defined. You can take it to be pi if you want, or 2 or 6, doesn't really matter. But provided it's at least order 1, then this overlap is exponentially small. So you've killed the commutator with the Hamiltonian to all orders in 1 of n. The only thing that remains is exponentially small. Okay? Good. So this is the proof of point one. It commutes with the Hamiltonian to all orders in perturbation theory. And now point two is sort of just as simple, if not more. So now we want to compute psi zero, some correlator, phi hat, psi zero. Right. So the question is now, how does this operator act on psi zero in its code subspace? Okay, good. So let's just write down what this thing is, minus t star. et psi zero. Now there's a bunch of O's. There's e to the minus it h p zero phi hat. Oh, sorry, phi hkll p zero e to the plus it h. And then maybe there's a bunch of other O's, and then there's psi zero. Okay. But this you can just rewrite in the following way. Et psi zero, PT by HKLL shifted of T, PT, and then a bunch of O's. And again, because there's projectors PT and the state psi zero, if T is greater than zero, this is going to be exponentially suppressed it'll go like e to the minus m squared. So basically, this entire thing behaves as e to the minus t squared m squared. Okay? And so you can evaluate it by saddle points. The saddle point is just t equals to zero. And so, you know, to leading order up to 1 over n corrections, this thing just gives you the value at t equals zero, which at t equals zero is just phi of HKLL. And then there's a bunch of those. Okay, so the idea is that when you look at the correlators with this operator, it has a time integral, but you know it's super sharply peaked around t equals zero. So it's a leading order in large n, which controls the saddle. You have a saddle of t equals to zero, and the saddle value is just the correlation function of the HKLL operator. Okay, and then there's 1 over n corrections that come from taking into account a little bit of integral around t equals to zero. Okay, But this was the proof of the second point, is that to leading order at large n, it behaves like the HKLL operator.
Hi, okay. Alex, can I pop in and ask a really naive question, just I might be getting a little bit lost in the details of the construction. So the idea here is you're going to have this HKLL operator and modify it in this prescribed way so that it's going to commute with the Hamiltonian at all orders in 1 over n. And so is kind of the expectation or the takeaway or what you're building to is that once you have this kind of construction, you can say, aha, I don't need to violate the Gauss law in gravity because now I can dress this thing to some surface that doesn't go to the boundary, like doesn't have to extend to the asymptotic boundary. Like you can do it like dressed to the quantum extremal surface or something. And that's kind of what the, what this operator's role in life is going to be.
Exactly. So since this is perfect timing, thank you, Natalie. So let's go to the interpretation and what do we make of this?
Yeah, we didn't collude.
No, this is great. This is ergonomically flowing into where I wanted to go. So this is perfect. So what's the interpretation? The interpretation is that, we had our supernova here. There was some infalling matter, a gigantic explosion, and matter coming out. And we started with an operator that was the HKLL operator. And because it's an HKLL operator, it's dressed with respect to the boundary. That's what an HKLL does, okay? And then what we do is we run our operator through our machinery, okay? And now this new operator commutes with the Hamiltonian, right? Which means it can no longer be dressed with respect to the boundary. So what is it dressed with respect to? Well, the idea is that now, the interpretation is that now it's dressed with respect to a feature of the state, in particular to the supernova, okay? So basically, how did we specify? So this state has a large feature in the bulk, a large semi-classical feature, which is a supernova explosion. And what we're saying is, don't specify the location of the operator from the boundary. What you're going to do is say how far this operator is from the supernova explosion, okay? And that's diff invariance, and that's a way to, so what our procedure does is it moves the dressing from the boundary to a feature of the quantum state, okay? So this is, the interpretation is that this is a state-dressed operator. And, if you had started, with, a state that has an end of the world brain behind the horizon, you would have started with an HKLL operator, that's dressed with respect to the boundary. You run this procedure. And now the idea is that the state is going to be dressed with respect to the end of the world. The operator is going to be dressed with respect to the end of the world brain. Okay, and so on and so forth for all the other types of states. The idea is that you use a property of the quantum state to dress the operator rather than dressing it to the boundary. Okay, so this is the interpretation, and this is why we think about them as state dressed operators. But there are a couple of important comments that I need to make.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Is the Akhtin project is highly complex? I just wonder, so from the entanglement wedge reconstruction stuff, it seems that this kind of dressing on the end of the world brain seems to be highly complex.
What is the precise question? So first of all, there are operators that are located, say, in islands that are very complex to start with, right? To reconstruct them from the radiation, they're going to be very complex, right? I think that statement is independent of the question of dressing. Now, maybe what you're asking is, if you take an operator that is not complex, say we don't have a Python lunch scenario, it's some operator that's easy to reconstruct, do you make it complex by dressing it with respect to the end of the world brain, say? The answer is, I don't know for sure, but I don't expect so. But I haven't thought about it very much. Okay. I don't think that this operation should drastically change the complexity of the operator somehow.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's just moving the dressing, from the boundary to to
originally if you deal with HKLL, the operator is easy to just write in terms of safety operators in the perturbation engineered, right? And but the this after the projection, the operator cannot be written in terms of perturbation theory, and this is exponentially difficult to write in terms of CFT operators. Is that your statement?
No, I think I was trying to say the opposite. I was trying to say that it doesn't change the complexity of the operator, how you dress it. But maybe I need to think about it more. Okay, the short answer is I have not thought about how moving the dressing affects the complexity of an operator. I would have thought that the most important thing for the how hard it is to reconstruct an operator is, you know, whether it's outside or in an island state. You know, do you have a Python's lunch or do you not? So the dressing is a sort of subtlety that you sprinkle on top of this story to make it really well-defined and diff-invariant. But I don't think it's the crucial ingredient that tells you whether the operator is complex or not.
Okay.
But I could be wrong. I haven't thought about it. Yeah.
Okay. And then a naive question as an outsider again. So the statement that you're making that suddenly this operator is just with respect to whatever is happening in the bulk is because, well, you know, your construction is state dependent, and now because it's invariant under the time translations, it's not tied to the boundary. That's what you're saying, or
yeah,
or what's that's the right. Okay, that's all.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, if you try to take our operator and act on a time shifted state, okay, it's not gonna shift where the bulk local operator acts. It always acts. So you know, so if you act with phi hat on, so maybe I should go here. So you know, here's t equals zero, which is sort of where we inserted the operator, right? Okay, and now I look at the state, you know, at t equals, I don't know, t naught or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So the state has evolved a little bit, and I act with that with our operator on the state psi of t naught.
Yeah.
It doesn't create an operator up here, right? It does not create an operator here. It creates an operator at the same location. You've specified where it is next to the supernova, and it doesn't matter if it acts on t equals zero or t equals t naught.
But like all the bulk geometry is somehow implicit in like the Hamiltonian you're using to evolve
So
it's like
The details. So the details of the geometry are, you know, encoded in psi zero and in some very complicated way in the projector. But so we don't see the bulk geometry from this formula. It's all encoded in, you know, very, you know, implicitly in psi zero. Yeah. Great. Yeah. These are all great questions. Okay, good. So just a couple of comments, and then I'll finish. I'll try to finish on time. So I said evidence. Why didn't I say a proof? It's because what I showed is that, I guess phi hat commutes with H, right? I didn't show that it commutes with all other single trace operators. So that's one thing that remains to be done. That we're thinking about is can you also show that the commutator with all other single trace operators is zero?
Doesn't that seem like a big jump? Or maybe as a naive, like as an outsider, I would say like if I did the very like kind of too dumb of a way to do it, like for it to be accurate, but like saying that I can take an operator and create its time average and say now that it's invariant under time translation says nothing about it commuting with other local operators in the theory, right? Like, but it's not what you're doing. So sorry, I'm just
It's not exactly. You see, we're not just doing the time average, right? Because first of all, that would sort of delocalize the operator in time. Here, it's located in a very special point, but we're using the projector, which is kind of crucial. I think that's what localizing it in the bulk. And this question, I think, is not as subtle as you might think, because you know, if you start with QFT on a fixed supernova background. Okay, say you have a scalar field theory on a fixed supernova background, you know that this is already true for all other single trace operators, right? So you start with a situation where phi, you can just use that, in that case, the HKLL operator, and it does commute with all other single trace operators. Because in QFT,
because they're all in the time, like because of their own
Because they're spatially separated in ADS and things commute.
But I thought your time window was such that you could have operators that are like, still on the boundary.
So the idea is that, you know, here's your time band, yeah. here's the causal development and an operator here.
Sure, yeah.
Commutes with everything that's in here in QFD
native. Yeah, sure.
They're basically separated. So you know, when gravity is not dynamical at all, this part works. And then the problem is that when you make gravity dynamical, the HKL operator, you know, has a problem here, okay? Mm-hmm. So we fixed the problem here. The only thing that you might worry about is that we haven't really fixed the problem. We've just pushed it into something else. Okay, so that's the thing, that's the residual thing that we would need to have. If we have this, I think then we have a proof. And then we can just sort of really prove that you can localize information in perturbative quantum gravity. But this needs to be done, okay? So I don't know, to be continued. We're thinking about it. Good. The other comment is about which states. Okay, so you might say, oh, but at the beginning you were telling us that, you know, Olga and Subrat and Victor and friends had a proof that you cannot do this around the ADS vacuum. And in fact, our construction, so if you take psi zero and want it to be the ADS vacuum, then our construction doesn't work. Okay, technically it's because if you're in the vacuum, psi of t, psi zero, or practically, doesn't decay, right? The overlap is just time independent. You're in an energetic state. Turns out on top of it, you're in the vacuum, okay? And physically, it kind of makes sense because if you're in vacuum ADS, there is no feature with respect to which you can dress an operator, right? In ADS, every point is as good as any other point. So there's nothing that you can use to try to, you know, anchor an operator at. The only thing you have is the boundary, and hence, any local operator that you'll try to create will not commute with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so we don't have any contradiction with the results in their paper because our construction just simply doesn't work for the vacuum. In fact, the vacuum is pretty confusing, I would say. And finally, the last comment that I want to make, and then I'll finish, is about islands. So there was some concerns in islands. I don't know what type of island setup I would consider. Maybe let me just do some ADS thing coupled to a bath, and then at some point in time, an island forms, which is supposed to be encoded in, you know, in the radiation in the non-gravitating bath. And then there was a puzzle in the story of the island, is that, okay, if the operator here can, if some operator in the island can be reconstructed from the radiation, it means that it should commute with the Hamiltonian that's here, right? Because all the operators in the green region commute with the Hamiltonian of the quantum dot. Okay, so the operator phi should commute with H. Okay, by construction, if you build it from the green region. But then there's the question of the dressing. Where do you dress the operator? What do you dress the operator of? I mean, where do you anchor the operator phi? And the only place you think you would anchor it, you can anchor it, is on the quantum dot itself and the boundary, right? So you might think that the only thing that you can do is this. And then there seems to be a paradox because if you dress it this way, it will not commute to the Hamiltonian. So then our construction can also help in this situation, because if you give me this operator with this dressing, so if you give me phi in this way, I can transform it into a phi hat that will commute with the Hamiltonian. You just run it through our procedure. Okay, so in that case, the interpretation will be that you dress it with respect to the radiation, although it may not be so sort of geometrical as in the other cases where we could dress it, you know, with respect to a supernova. But nothing prevents us from using our prescription and constructing now a new operator that is not dressed with respect to the boundary. Okay. So in this way, you could avoid puzzles of this type in the context of islands. Okay, but I'm over time, and I was trying not to. So let me just stop here and thank you for your attention.
Thank you.